Hello everyone, Joshua Gilliland here, one of the two bloggers on the Legal Geeks. Today I have a special guest, Mike Towery. You might not know his name right off the bat unless you've been to San Diego Comic-Con or San Diego Comic Fest. Mike helped start San Diego Comic-Con, which has been a huge contribution to all things geek in the world. Mike, how are you today?
Good, a little hot and muggy down here in San Diego, but I'm doing good. And thanks for inviting me on your show, Josh.
My pleasure. It's great to have you. I mean, the world owes you a debt, you and all your friends. And thank you for that. For those who don't know your story, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, as far as Comic-Con goes, back in 1969, I was a 14-year-old comic dealer, bought and sold back issue comics through the mail, and there were a couple other kids in my neighborhood, a little older than me, Bob Sork and Richard Alf, who also bought and sold comics. And Richard, who was the most advanced of us all, he had just put an ad in Marvel Comics, and I was soon to follow that later and put my own ad in Marvel Comics and, you know, shipping my catalog around and all that. So that was a lot of fun. And so Richard and I had kind of been talking about trying to organize like sort of a comic collector swap meet or something, but we hadn't gotten very far in it. We were thinking, oh, maybe in my mom's backyard, you know, we could set up tables or something and whatnot. And there was no organized fandom in San Diego at the time. And then one day in, like late summer, early fall, Richard got a hold of me and said that he had gotten a call from this guy named Shell Dorff. And Shell was out here from Detroit and wanted to talk to us about maybe doing a comic convention. And Richard wasn't sure if he was, you know, legit or not, because he was pretty old. You know, he was 35. And so that was pretty ancient, you know. And that was the days of don't trust anyone over 30 and all that, you know. So we weren't sure, but, you know, we thought we'd go give him a chance. And, you know, I came to find out that Shell had, back in Detroit, he had helped put on one of the first, depending on how you decide things, he had helped put on probably, I guess you would consider it, the second comic convention in the country. It was in Detroit, and it was called the Detroit Triple Fanfare. And he and Jerry Bales, who was one of the founders of, who was probably the founder of comic fandom itself, had helped put it on. And Shell had helped his parents retire from Detroit out here to San Diego in 69. And when he saw how wonderful things were in Southern California in the late 60s, he decided not to go back. So he stayed in San Diego. And, you know, he wanted to get active again in comic conventions and comic fandom. And so was trying to, you know, contact people here.
That is so cool to hear, and so many thoughts. So were there bags and boards with your first comic book collecting business?
Bags we got into before the boards. So we were doing bags, and in fact I used to advertise that I would, with my catalog, I would send a free sample comic bag. And so that was pretty advanced collecting, I guess, back in 1969. But
that is so awesome. Now, had you gone to a comic book convention of any sort prior
No, I didn't. I didn't even know they existed. Richard and I, like I said, we had talked about maybe doing some kind of like comic collector swap meet or whatnot. In those days, of course, there was no internet. And so it was a little harder to get information. There were fanzines that people would advertise in exchange for the mail, and they used to print addresses in the letter columns in like Marvel or DC Comics. Julie Schwartz, who was an old-time science fiction fan who edited a lot of DC titles, he had realized how when Hugo Gernsback put the addresses on fan letters in his science fiction pulps, that really helped develop science fiction fandom and help fans contact each other. So they used to do that. And so it was one of the ways you could get a hold of fans. There was a big fanzine in those days called the Rocket Blast Comic Collector. Was produced by a guy named G.B. Love out of Texas. And and his story is remarkable. He was severely disabled and had to peck out his issues of his fanzine with like a pencil gripped in his fist, and you know, one letter at a time. But he was a really wonderful person, and he was a great fan, and he did this immense service to early fandom of this fanzine. So Richard read that. So I think Richard, though he didn't really say, he used to keep things close to the vest and not share all his knowledge necessarily. I think he knew a little more than I did about comic conventions when Shell showed up, but I didn't have any knowledge of them myself.
What a wonderful, I mean, dedicated fan. That's wow. When I think of going to conventions, my first one that I went to was Time Con in 1985 in San Jose. And, you know, there's a mystique about going to any type of geek convention, comic book, sci-fi. What do you think makes comic book conventions special?
I think comic conventions, I'll tell you, when we first, one of the most important things we did when we were first starting to work on Comic-Con back in November of 1969 was we went and visited Jack Kirby up in Irvine. He had just moved out from New York. He was the first big comic professional to do that. And of course, he was the king of comics. And, you know, we went up and we met Jack. And one of the things we talked about was the convention that we were planning to do, and you know, asked his advice about it. And in fact, I don't know if you'd like to hear what the advice was that Jack gave us back in 1969.
Anything Kirby told you was gold. So yes, the world wants to know.
Well, the transcript actually of our first conversation with Jack was printed a while back in this magazine called The Jack Kirby Collector. It was issue number 42. And I'll read it here, this little section. We asked Jack, we said, we're at the point now where we're trying to decide whether this should be just strictly a comic convention or if we should include the fans of science fiction, the fans of films, and so on. What would your idea be about this? And Jack said, I'd do it all, do comics. Do anything that's been relevant to it. I know that comic fans have also been interested in the movie media. They've been interested in the pulp media, and all that has some value to them. I think they want to see it. I don't think they want to concentrate on comics alone. If you can widen the scope of the convention to include all these, I think you'll have a larger crowd and a more interesting crowd, and I think you'll have a great time. And so, of course, you know, that's what we did. And that also matched up well with Shell's experience with the Detroit convention, which was called the Detroit Triple Fan Fair, and the triple stood for comics, science fiction, and films. So from the beginning, we were all inclusive, all these things, though comics were the main focus, comic fans loved all these other things. And so we included them all together, and they all could play off one another. And you could have the science fiction authors that maybe wrote stories that ended up becoming comics, or they became movies, or the movies inspired the comics, and all these people together, and it was a chance to meet them. And so, you know, I think that's one the thing that's been special about comic conventions.
Yeah, totally. It is such a unique experience, big or small, you know, because of the quality of people there. They care. They are so hardcore. They love the material. You know, when you think of San Diego Comic-Con, people waiting in line hours for Hall H, or those who, you know, go along the main hallway and go from session to session or walk the exhibit floor. It's impressive. I mean, it takes dedication. But you've done something so few others, you know, have, at least, you know, like because of my age. You met Kirby. What was he like?
Oh, Kirby, he was wonderful. He was just, he had this almost sort of Edward G. Robinson style of speaking where he would use the word see as a period into sentence. So he'd say, so I was doing this story about Galactus, see, and he was going up against the Fantastic Four, and I brought the Silver Surfer in here to do this, see, and you know, and so it was very cool. He had a very old school New York way of speaking, and of course he grew up in a in the ghetto in New York. and he grew up very poor, and that really influenced his work ethic and concerns about always being able to put bread on the table and have work for his so that he could provide for his family, because he came out of these this situation of privation when he was young. But even despite the fact that he had such a work ethic and he spent just insane hours at the drawing board, when we came up to visit him, he would stop everything and he would spend the whole day with us. He would spend hours with us. And the first time we went up there, his wife Roz made hamburgers for us, and he would get out old art that he did when he was a kid and show us stuff that he did when he worked as an animator at Fleischer Studios, and tell us old stories about things and tell us his army stories. And he never talked down to us. He would tell us what was on his mind. He would tell us his philosophy, his ideas, what was important to him, what he thought about things. And it was really a wonderful experience.
I'd be so starstruck. It's just that level of imagination and creativity and being able to transfer it to a visual medium.
Well, talking about being starstruck, the first time we visited him in November of 69, our youngest member of our group, Barry Alfonso, who was actually the first one of us who met Shell, when we first walked in and met Jack, Barry, who was 12, as I said, he walked up to him. And in all seriousness, he said this. He said, should we call you King or Mr. Kirby? And of course, Jack didn't know what to say to that. He just kind of got a little flustered, and you could tell that he was flattered, and he knew Barry was serious. And so he just kind of laughed and didn't quite know what to say, but he loved Barry after that, I'll tell you. And he actually made Barry into a comic character twice.
Oh, that's awesome.
And yeah, Barry is, I don't know if you're familiar with, there were a group of us actually, who he put in one of his, when he did his Kirby's Fourth World, and he did Jimmy Olsen with Superman and Jimmy Olsen. So we were actually a villainous rock band called the San Diego Five String Mob. And we secretly worked for Darkseid. And so we actually went up against Superman, and then our secret weapon was Barry Boy, who was Barry Alfonso, so that was a lot of fun. And I got to my character, as we're escaping through the boom tube, I got to trash talk Superman, and I got away with it. So,
Oh, that would go on a t-shirt. I envy you, sir. That's amazing.
And then later Jack drew Barry as the character Witch Boy, which I don't know if you're familiar with him, but
I will ask Google later. I'm not familiar with that character, but that's quite a resume builder. I've been two comic book characters after meeting Jack Kirby. That's a few people can say that. How did the Kirby meeting occur? Did somebody just write him a letter or call?
Well, Shell had found out that in the summer of 69 that Jack had moved out here to Irvine. So a friend of Shell's, a comic collector friend, I think it was Rich Rubenfeld was his name, and he came out and visited, and he and Shell went up and visited Kirby. And then after Shell met us and asked us if we'd like to do a comic convention, and we were sort of not sure all about it, because we didn't know if Shell was legitimate, and we were just teenagers, and like I said, he's this guy from Detroit in his 30s, and we don't know what to make of him. But one day we came over to his place, and we were sitting around talking about the convention, and he just said to us, he goes, boys, because that's what he would call us, you boys, so he goes, boys, how many of you are familiar with Jack Kirby? And, we all raised our hands. Of course, that's what you did back then. If you were a kid, an adult said, asked you something, you raised your hand, right? So we all raised our hands. And then he goes, how many of you have ever met Jack Kirby or talked to him? And then we all put our hands down, and, we're kind of looking at each other like, that doesn't even make sense. That's a preposterous question. It's like, how many of you have ever met Zeus? Obviously he's on some comet creator Mount Olympus. It's not you can't meet somebody like him. And so then Shell gets this smile, and he goes, how many of you would like to talk to Jack Kirby? And we're like, what? Really? And so then Shell got this phone. It was, you know, one of the old rotary phones, and he made this big kind of show of it. He had this smile on his face, and he picked up the hand, you know, the handset or the receiver, and starts, you know, turning the dial of this number, and we're all watching him. And, you know, finally he's listening to the phone, and obviously it got answer, and he goes, Roz, this is Shell. Is Jack there? And then there's a little pause, and then we hear Shell go, Jack? Yeah, hi, Jack. This is Shell. I'm here with the boys. They want to talk to you. And so, sure enough, he just passed, handed the phone over to the first one of us, and then we just passed the phone from one to another and said, you know, it's like we didn't really know what to say. It's just sort of like, Mr. Kirby, I like really admire your work, you know, that sort of thing. But, you know, we got to talk to Jack Kirby. And then after that, he arranged for us to be able to go up there. So we all pooled our money together and rented a station wagon for like $50. And we all drove, Shell drove us up there, and Barry's mom drove him and a friend of his. We got to visit Jack Kirby, which was just amazing. And after that, you know, we just thought, well, gee, you know, if Shell can deliver on meeting Jack Kirby, then this is legit. We can do this. We can do a comic convention. And so we were sold after that.
I strongly believe in, you know, I don't believe in the no-win scenario. You know, don't tell me what's impossible because we pull it off. And you guys went out and lived it. That's just phenomenal. You know, if this podcast had video, you would see I'm grinning just because this is so cool to hear. So when the first San Diego Comic-Con was held, you know, what was the first one like? And, you know, in those early years, what was the experience like for the attendees?
Well, the very first thing we actually did was in March of 1970, we did a one-day mini convention, we called it, which was, we wanted to try to raise a little money for our big three-day convention and also just a trial run just to see what it was like. So we had it in the basement of the U.S. Grant Hotel, which was pretty run down in those days. I don't, you probably don't know San Diego in those days, but downtown was, they hadn't done the gas lamp and the Horton Plaza developments, and it was kind of run down, and it was sort of just a sailor town, and you know, for all that meant back in those days, and it's like, you know, probably nice people didn't go from the suburbs downtown a lot and that sort of thing, and hotels were run down, and so, but that was actually good for us because they were willing to take a comic convention, even though we weren't going to be a big money maker for them or anything. We were in the basement of the U.S. Grant Hotel and a one-day convention. I think we had like 150 people. And, of course, there's probably that much in a line to Starbucks at Comic-Con now. And we had two guests. We had Mike Royer, who was an artist and inker. And he became, actually, shortly thereafter, he became Jack Kirby's favorite inker on his Fourth World books. And he also was, he inked Magnus Robot Fighter and the Tarzan comic strip and Star Wars newspaper strip for Russ Manning. And then later on, he actually went on to become the chief Winnie the Pooh designer for Disney. And Mike's actually coming to the Comic Fest this February, which is very cool. And our other guest was Forrest Ackerman, who was the creator of Famous Monsters of Filmland. He was the number one science fiction fan. He had been since the late 30s. And, you know, he was, again, it was a wonderful thing. He decided to, you know, just take a chance on this unknown little group of comic fans and come down and talk to us. And, you know, and he just kept coming back and back and back to Comic-Con up until he, you know, passed away. He was a regular guest at Comic-Con. So that was a lot of fun. And then, in August of that year, we had our first, you know, three-day convention, our big convention, which was probably like 300 people or something like that. But we had Jack Kirby was our comic guest of honor, and our science fiction guest of honor, improbably enough, considering the little newbie group we were, was Ray Bradbury. So we had the top science fiction author and the top comic artist at our little tiny first three-day convention.
That's heroic. It's just so heroic. Did the two interact together?
I'm sure they, you know, I don't recall. I was there I had a table set up and I was selling comics. So I was actually at my table most of the time. No, it's actually, if you'd like to hear, it's a really interesting story about how Ray Bradbury came to come to the first Comic-Con.
Yes, please. This is amazing. Yes.
Well, in December of 1969, Richard Alf, he was getting ready. He was going to go to UCSD, the University of California in San Diego, and he was going to be a music major there. So he was kind of keeping track on what was going on at UCSD. And in their newspaper, the Daily Triton, I think it was called at the time, there was an announcement that Ray Bradbury was coming to the campus to speak. And so he told Shell, and so Richard and Shell went out one night to hear Ray Bradbury speak at UCSD. And Shell had heard that Ray was a big comic strip fan. And so Shell had some scrapbooks where he had collected. Shell was a big comic strip fan. That was what he really loved. Dick Tracy and Terry and the Pirates. And so he brought out his couple scrapbooks of comic strips. And then after the talk, Ray was standing around talking to people, and Shell passed the scrapbook up for him to look at. And so Ray looked at that and he goes, oh, is this for me to keep? And then Shell goes, oh, no, I just brought him to show you because I understood you like comics. So they got talking. And so Shell says, Mr. Bradbury, we're putting on a comic convention in August, and we'd sure like it if you could attend as a guest. And so he goes, well, sure, I'd be willing to come. I'll give you the contact information for my manager. You'll have to pay for my train down because I don't fly, and, put me up at a hotel room and then pay my standard speaking fee of $5,000. So, in 1969, $5,000 was probably like what, $30,000, $40,000 today at least. And so, there's no way we had anything remotely like that. And so, Richard and Shell were crestfallen. And then Shell got this bright idea. And we had never, just to show you how kind of like naive and innocent we were getting into this comic convention thing, we hadn't even talked about what kind of structure it would have as to whether or not it would be for profit or non-profit. That didn't even occur to us. We just thought, oh boy, we're going to do a comic convention. There's going to be a lot of fans there and a lot of artists and writers. It'll be so cool. So anyway, Shell all of a sudden gets this idea. He says, oh, Mr. Bradbury, we don't have that kind of money. We're just a small group of fans who are doing this as an educational service to the public. And we're a nonprofit group. And so Ray goes, oh, well, in that case, I'll come for free. And he did. And that's the story of actually how Comic-Con became nonprofit.
And somebody who could think quickly on their feet, that's... This is why it's important to have at least one lawyer buddy who can handle these things. It's like, whoa, guys, who's going to handle the contracts? Who's going to insure this thing? You don't personally want to sign for the venue. We need an organization to do it. Yeah, being able to think certificate of insurance, there are all those unfun things that have your lawyer friend take care of, because we're generally good at that paperwork. So,
right.
But that's, you guys are teenagers and a guy who's 35. This is, that's very forgivable. You didn't have a lawyer in your hip pocket to call up and go, hey, Bob, can you help me with this? That being said, if you do need a hand ever, let me know. I am good at paperwork. That's so phenomenal. So, thinking from like 1970 up to 2015, how are the shows to San Diego Comic Con today similar to 1970, 1971, and how are they different?
Well, the obvious difference is the size and the money that's put into it, the kind of gigantic trade show type exhibits that they have now, and that kind of almost like major trade show vibe that you get down on the exhibitors floor now, which to us was just the dealer's room. That was like guys coming in with stacks of comics and old books and putting them up on a table, and that's what we were. And there was none of the publishers weren't interested in us. Hollywood certainly was not interested in us. I mean, I think honestly, we would love to have had some of these actors and whatnot that come to Comic-Con so readily now, but you know, people just weren't interested. Everybody, I think, pretty much looked down on comics in those days. Even most of the people I think who did comics kind of looked down on it and were a little embarrassed that's what they did. And that's why I think that one service we provided really was that we were able to tell these people like Kirby and stuff that no, what you do is wonderful and we really value it. It's just super important to us. And we think what you do is just terrific. And Sheldorf actually said that when he got involved in doing comic conventions, that one of the reasons was he felt that comic artists were like one of the groups that never got to hear the applause because they just worked at their tables and they never heard, they didn't really know much from the companies about the response to their comics and they never met their fans. And so he felt that if you had comic conventions and you could have the creators come as guests, they could finally hear the applause and they could realize the kind of effects they were having on people and how much the fans really enjoyed what they were doing and valued what they did, and you know, and that's really how it's worked out.
I totally agree. I, you know, this past year was my first time attending San Diego Comic-Con, and I attended several of the Marvel and DC panels to hear the different authors and the artists speak, and it was cool. I mean, it was so cool to actually hear them and talking about, you know, the process and what they're working on. And like today's creators, you know, the younger ones especially are very active on Twitter. Mm-hmm. And so I do think they get some more of the applause that sure. Prior generations, you know, didn't get, other than letters and the other, you know, more traditional ways to show appreciation for works of art. But it was really cool. Now, for those who don't know, like, you helped get us in because you were the one who pitched our Star Wars topic, and you know, got us in the door. And it was an amazing experience to play Rockstar for an hour at Comic-Con. I didn't mention this, but there were probably about a dozen lawyers who attended our panel, who were sent by their firms to check it out.
Really?
Yeah. So after about a couple days afterwards, I had a call from one of my friends who I went to law school with, who was a partner in a firm and he does patent work. And he called to say that his associate had reported on our panel and that we had done a good job because he had sent her to attend. She got paid to go to Comic-Con for work.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And so you know, even the judge commented, there were, you know, several of the lawyers had appeared before him, and they were geeks.
That's interesting.
Yeah, so it's a really cool thing that, you know, just from my perspective, being the lawyer, seeing that there are other attorneys and judges who are into science fiction and comics and, you know, these movies, it's totally fantastic. It's a neat experience. Which brings us to San Diego Comic Fest. I got to go for a day last year and I really enjoyed it. And you know, thank Comic Fest was the first time I actually presented at a Comic-Con. And so thank you for that. But could you tell our listeners a little bit about San Diego Comic Fest, when it is, and what's it about?
Well, where it really started, I think, was back in 2009. It was the 40th Comic-Con, and they had a big celebration, and they invited as guests people who had you know, worked on the various older conventions in the early days. So, you know, Richard Alf and I went, and there were a number of other. Barry Alfonso was there, and a number of the other early people, and you know, it was a lot of fun and catching up with people. But one thing I noticed was there were a lot of people I'd heard and complaining about Comic-Con. Oh, it's, you know, it's too big, and there's so much Hollywood now, and you know, and there's all these big lines and stuff, and so. I mean, and I understood that they missed the intimacy and the the casualness of the early conventions, but I didn't think it was really reasonable to complain about what Comic-Con was, because I was really proud of what Comic-Con had become. I thought, you know, it was just amazing that you know, our little despised corner of the popular arts had actually conquered, and it had become, you know, so successful and high profile, and I was glad of it, and you know, to see so many people there, especially young people, just having a amazing, wonderful time. I thought that was very cool, but I understood, you know, why you would also want a smaller event. So I thought, instead of, you know, complaining that it's not a small event anymore, it would be make more sense to create a small event, and then you could have both. There's no reason you couldn't have both. And I thought it was a little bit, somebody, actually it was a reporter from a local TV station, kind of brought up this analogy, and I've always thought it was a good one, because when I was trying to explain to her, you know, what was different between Comic Fest and Comic Con, and she then put it on her own terms. She said, oh, I get it. It's like Comic Con is the big stadium show with the Jumbotron displays and pyrotechnics and fireworks and all this and the huge crowds, and Comic Fest is like the intimate club date where you go in a small venue and you're right up next to the stage, and you can respond immediately to the artists, who you can look, you know, you see each other in the eye, and then maybe afterwards they might come down and mingle with the crowd, and so I think some people might prefer one sort of event to another, but I think most people would like them both. And so that's why I decided to start the Comic Fest and try to recreate that enjoyable vibe that we had at the old Comic Cons, and let people enjoy that sort of event again too.
I like both. You know, it's seeing Comic Con is such a unique experience. It's big. There's a lot of activity, you know, just all the panel content that's offered is a phenomenal amount of information. And from how action figures are designed to lost interviews with Jack Kirby, I mean, it's just phenomenal material that they have. And you could literally not ever go near Exhibit Hall H or the actual show floor.
Right.
And you know, like, leave with amazing knowledge. So on the flip side, the smaller shows really allow you to interact with people, actually talk with people and visit with folks. There was somebody who recognized me at Comic-Con from Comic Fest.
Oh, yeah, and, cool.
Yeah, oh, I had a total geek out moment from I was going by, Abbey Clothetiers. They make really awesome costumes, and one of the gentleman who was in the booth recognized me because he was a Geeky Awards judge, and the guy standing next to him had seen me present at Comic Fest, and I was flying high. It was just like, wow, this is really cool. You recognized me. I'm not wearing a bow tie and a Star Wars T-shirt, and you guys saw me. So both are important. Both are totally important. Now, when is the next Comic Fest coming up?
It's going to be next President's Day weekend, February 12 to 15, okay. 2016.
Awesome. And it's at a resort down in San Diego. Which one?
The Town and Country Resort and Convention Center. It's in the Mission Valley area of San Diego.
And that's just a trolley ride up from the airport, and you're good to go. And where can people learn more?
SDComicFest.org is the website. Now, or you can just Google Comic Fest, and it'll come up.
Now, I've seen on Facebook you guys rolling out some of the different guests who are being announced. Can you give us some of the other highlights of individuals we can check out at the show?
I've been talking to Legal Geeks about coming down and doing a presentation. So we're hoping to see that again. Some of the other guests that we're having, we're really happy. We're going to be having the couple of the preeminent British comics creators, Brian and Mary Talbot, are actually coming over from London. And it's pretty exciting. Brian Talbot, if you look on the website under the page for Brian and Mary Talbot, Brian Talbot is considered to be the guy who pretty much inspired everybody who came after him, such as Alan Moore, Neil Gaiman, Grant Morrison, to explore what more could be done with comics that hadn't been done. He was the original guy. He did the first steampunk graphic novel. And he did a lot of the early experimentation and different kinds of stories that you could tell with comics. And his wife, Mary Talbot, has recently started writing with him. And she wrote a graphic novel that he illustrated called Daughter of Her Father's Eyes. That was a combined autobiography of her and her relationship with her father, who was a James Joyce scholar, and then James Joyce's daughter. And she intertwined the stories. It was really remarkable. And Neil Gaiman actually said he thought it was a work of genius and was one of the best things he had read. And it actually it was the first graphic novel to ever win the prestigious Costas Biography Award in England. And so anyway, they're both coming over, and we're really looking forward to that for them. And Greg Bear is our science fiction guest of honor, because you know we do science fiction movies as well as comics. And so Greg Bear, of course, he's from San Diego originally. He's a Nebula and Hugo winning author.
That's so cool. I'm really looking forward to it and in participating and coming up with something fun. And so stay tuned. So let's end with, you know, who are some of your favorite comic book characters? Do you have a storyline that you've really, you know, like that's meant something to you?
Well, for me, it was really Kirby's work. When he had his run on Fantastic Four, that was my comic. Those first 100 issues or whatever of that Kirby did, and of course the other work that he did, Thor and a lot of the other comics. You know, they were wonderful too. But it was really, for me, it was the Fantastic Four. I was all about that. Now, of course, I loved Ditko's Spider-Man and then, you know, getting to actually meet Kirby and it was one of those things, you know, there's that thing about like never meet your idols that people say, is because, you know, when you find out what they're like, then you'll be disappointed, because anytime then you'll always be thinking about what they're really like or something. But with Kirby, it just made it all the better, because here I found out that this guy who did these wonderful comics was actually a wonderful person. And so it just made it all the better for me.
Oh, that's so phenomenal. I, you know, like looking ahead, I do hope that we do get Fantastic Four. It's like a Netflix series, like something in the way it should be seen. And I really do hope that they do incorporate the Kirby vehicles, you know, like that look, that technology. And you know, I'm hoping they start doing that on Agent Carter, because that is such a classic tribute to the original comics that he did. It'd be neat to see that on the screen, because it's so iconic, absolutely iconic. Well, Mike, you are amazing to talk to. I really enjoy hearing, you know, your adventures in comics from what you've done, and I appreciate your time and look forward to seeing you at Comic Fest in February.
Great. Well, we'll see you there.
Take care. Thank you, everyone. Thank you for tuning in.